I remember reading some of the columns by Nick Kristof in New York Times about people he went to school with up in Washington. And he talked about who was on the bus with me as a kid in school. And how for one family, had like 5 boys. And all of them were either dead or in jail. I'm saying, oh, that's white folks. They're also dead in jail. That could be like a quote-unquote black story. So what happens sometimes, we ignore the overarching issue of the system.
We have members who have 30 plus years of seniority who have been cut and have had to try to figure out the unemployment process. They are all struggling very hard, and this is so unnecessary. It's just a disservice to our community when we should be here to help our students.
And we stood together in protest, and when we first went out that first day, it was really emotional. And my daughters would say, wow, I feel so much hope. Look at all the different people out here. Look at all the white people who are standing with us.
Right.
I mean, we didn't know what to expect. And they're like, this is what we need. This is what it's going to take.
I think it's what people should be seeing for the future, is that unions are going to come across together, which I think is incredibly promising and powerful step.
With the coronavirus meeting the economic crisis right now, I think we have highlighted for the first time for everyone just how important it is for unity to be brought to this industry.
One of our members, Justin Blue, said, he was like, man, like, we're talking about working within the constraints of union business. Is there a way we can do this where we just do it on our own? Like, we just donate our own time and our own money, which that's a whole new ballgame.
Yeah.
And so we came up with this idea of, I put a graphic together. I put brothers and sisters helping brothers and sisters, because that's really what it is.
So the financialization of the housing market is the reason that so many people are struggling to get onto the housing ladder, and that our rents are so high. The role of debt and sort of the predatory loan system mean that many of us are ending up living off payday loans more than we are able to live off our wages. There's all sorts of ways in which finance is affecting every part of the economy.
I understand whiskey sometimes plays a key role. Is there any truth to that?
Well, not always, but I'll admit a few drams of open scotch definitely had a hand in this one.
You better listen, my brother, 'cause if you do, you can hear their voices still calling from across the years. And they're crying across the ocean, they're crying across the land, and they will until we all come to understand. None of us are free. None of us are free. None of us are free. If one of us is chained, none of us are free. None of us are free.
Welcome to the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. This week, on Black Work Talk, one of our newest network members, host Stephen Pitts welcomes Dorian Warren, president of Community Change, who discusses efforts around the country to build the collective power of black workers. On the Working to Live in Southwest Washington podcast, Vancouver school district classified employees have been furloughed for months, and they're struggling. Barb Plymite, president of the Vancouver Association of Educational Support Professionals, joins hosts Shannon and Harold to talk about the district's justification for these furloughs and the fact that it has the money to put these people back to work. On Willamette Wake Up, Rebecca Salinas Oliveros talks about her leap into local politics in Oregon. She started as an activist in the Black Lives Matter movement, then ran for Monmouth City Council. She was a top vote-getter in the recent city council election, despite opposition from a political action committee that supported a slate of conservative candidates. Labor Express Radio talks with Stroger Hospital nurse Elizabeth Lalish, a member of the National Nurses United, who works with COVID patients, about the likely effects of cuts in the Cook County hospital system on black and brown working class communities on the south side of Chicago and how nurses are organizing to fight for safe workplaces and patient-centered care. On Labor Lines, organizers for the Restaurant Workers Council report on their efforts to organize restaurant workers in New York City. The holidays are coming up soon, and on the Break Time Breakdown, Jeremy Waugh and Richard Roth talk about a new effort led by members of the Smart Local 110 Executive Board to help members in need for what will be a holiday season unlike any that have come before. Then, on Belabored, renewing unions in the age of finance. Elections come and go, but some major problems continue to plague labor unions on both sides of the Atlantic, and many of those problems have their roots in the financialization of our economy. Yet unions are often stuck in a playbook that was written in a different period of capitalist development, and it shows in their struggles. How do unions adapt to a financialized world? Alice Martin and Annie Quick have some suggestions. And on Grit Northwest, we meet the president of the Northwest Carpenters Union and Grit writer, producer, and host Joe Cadwell, who reveals the secret to a successful podcast. We wrap up with a promo for the San Francisco Mime Troupe's upcoming production of A Red Carol, a working-class take on the Dickens holiday classic. I'm Chris Garlock, and that's all ahead on today's Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, bringing you working people's voices with a selection of highlights from the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Here's the show.
None of us are free if one of us is chained. None of us are free. It's the very heart of humanity.
Hi, this is Stephen Pitts, the host of Black Work Talk, an organizing upgrade podcast. Here, we take a look at efforts around the country to build the collective power of Black workers. Today, my guest is Dorian Warren. I've known Dorian for over 15 years, as we have worked in different spaces to ensure that economic justice movements don't ignore the interests of Black workers, while simultaneously making sure that struggles for Black freedom include the battle to radically transform our political economy. We also share Southside Chicago connections, as we grew up around the block from each other. But I do need to remind myself that we were a generation apart. Dorian is the president of Community Change, the co-chair of the Economic Security Project, and co-host of a new podcast with Melissa Harris-Perry called System Check. A progressive scholar, organizer, and media personality, he has worked to advance racial, economic, and social justice for over two decades. Dorian, thanks for being on this show. You're my second guest. I truly appreciate you being here, man. Thanks a lot.
It is an honor and a pleasure, especially to come after the great Bill Fletcher and to be talking to you, Stephen. So thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
It's no problem, man. Yeah, I think we mentioned the system is like an overarching, you could call it a connecting thread amongst all peoples. I would say the system, we can call it political economy, we can call it capitalism, we can have different labels for it. But if you look at the question of how the economy is organized, how the economy interplays with other institutions, how power exists and doesn't exist to impact those things, that's kind of roughly the system itself. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, I think we don't look at that as being something that all of us face, meaning all people who live in this country. And it comes out in different ways. It's both racialized. It's both in different regional impacts. But I remember reading some of the columns by Nick Kristof in New York Times about people he went to school with up in Washington. And he talked about who was on the bus with me as a kid in school. And how for one family had like five boys. And all of them were either dead or in jail. I'm saying, oh, that's white folks. They're also dead in jail. That could be like a quote-unquote Black story. So what happens sometimes, we ignore the overarching issue of the system and raise the question how to impact races differently. genders differently, region differently, and we start with the idea of a region or a race or a gender. And a starting point, it can close off commonalities. I'm not saying that we have some automatic black, white, not be fight sort of thing at all. But I think somehow we need to talk about the problem, one, accurately, but also talk about it in a way people can see themselves in the problem itself.
Yes.
And to me, that's part of the part of the process where we do build a progressive governing majority. And I think that's something that's super complicated, by the way, because I joke about the answers and you don't have them. I don't have them. No one has them. But this notion of naming the system, naming how it impacts groups both similarly and differently, it's an important frame to go through our conversations.
So you just made me think of a couple of things. One is, I do think it's important. I'm totally there with you on naming the system. And there's lots of concepts we have. We've debated all the concepts, right? Is it class? Is it racial capitalism? Is it caste, right? We can have a debate about, but those are all tools, analytical tools, to help us understand the system. But the analysis might be different than strategy. And so I just want to make sure we keep those two things potentially separate and not mistake analysis or strategy. And then, but you actually raised something that I've been thinking a lot about, because I read a lot of history. I've been reading a lot about the Civil War and Reconstruction. And just thinking about the numbers of Americans who have died from COVID. So we're over 200,000 right now. And I've just been struck by, it does feel to me similar in a sense, with one exception, to the Civil War. I think there were something like 700,000 Americans lost who died because of the Civil War or fighting the war. And the difference to me now is one of the big technologies at the time, I think the Civil War was one of the first wars ever in human history to be photographed. Yeah. And the images of those dead bodies that were probably really gruesome landed in people's doorsteps. So that's just like one observation. But the deeper observation is the racism of Southern Confederates and plantation owners was so deep that they didn't even think black folk could actually serve and fight. And so what you had was hundreds of thousands of poor white Southerners who died in the Civil War, fighting to keep other people unfree. And that's just been circling in my head and thinking about, is this a period when we're in a soft civil war in this weird way? And the body count this time is from COVID-19 and the incompetence and intransigence of the current administration to even care. Like, I keep thinking like, oh, just like Southern plantation owners didn't care about poor white folks, neither does Trump and his enablers. And it's like, for poor white workers, it's, yo, the white oligarchs have never cared about y'all either. There is no universe in which they have cared about you either, except for when it's been politically expedient for them to hold onto power. And so that to me seems like, I do firmly believe like black workers need to organize as black workers. But I do think there is common ground at some point in terms of, if you use the category of worker, for instance, again, the system is screwing everybody. The system should be the best organizer. The system is the boss. And then what's our strategy? Again, once you make that analytical point, then what's the strategy to organize? And I come down on, I'm going to borrow from Lonnie Guinier and Gerald Torres from their, I think, 2002 book, The Miner's Canary. And I'm a firm believer, and I think this is really applicable to black workers, because from where the traditions I come from, black workers are the miner's canary of both the democracy and the economy. If you want to know the health of the system of our democracy, if you want to know the health of the system of our economy or racial capitalism, just look at where black workers are. And that, because the miner canary, let me finish that thought in terms of, for those that might not know, miners would take canaries into the coal mine because canaries have very tiny lungs. And so when there were toxic gases in the mine, in the system of the mine, canaries would get sick or die. Miners knew that there was danger and to get out. And so black workers have always been the miner's canary in this country, notifying and alerting and demanding that people pay attention to the deep system design flaws that are harmful and result in death and suffering, and then what to do about it. How do you offer up alternative systems? And so when I think of, I often use the miner's canary as a device to help us think about power. And I think there's not just one miner's canary in America. There's lots of miner's canary, depending on where you look. That's where gender comes in. If you look at, okay, where do women, what is the standing of women in the society, particularly Black women or queer folks? Or yes, workers are a miner's canary, and it falls along different racialized dimensions, but there are lots of miner's canaries. And what would it mean for all the canaries to unite to overthrow the system? And so that's how I come at a lot of these questions that you're asking me that I can't not answer. It's at least the process of my thinking.
So the slogan is, canaries of the world unite. You have nothing to lose but your bird cages. After, thanks a lot, man. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dr. Pitts. I will return the favor very soon and would love to have you on my own podcast. And also feel free to invite me back.
Thanks for joining me this week. And we need your help as we build the Black Work Talk community. Subscribe to the podcast wherever you find your podcast and go to Patreon to become a sustainer. Until the next episode, stay safe and be well.
Hello.
She's so friendly.
Oh, I was going to start.
That's okay. I'll leave that in just so I'm the one who's screwing up.
Hello, working people of Southwest Washington.
You're listening to episode 11 of Working to Live in Southwest Washington, produced by the Southwest Washington Central Labor Council. We're also a proud member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Find out more about the network at laborradionetwork.org.
I'm Shannon Myers.
And I'm Harold Phillips. We are lucky enough to have Barb Plymate, who is the president of the Vancouver Association of Educational Support Professionals, here with us. Barb, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Barb, classified employees, what does that term mean, classified?
So the certified employees are the teachers. They're certificated in teaching, where the classified employees are the support staff around the educational needs of the students. So in our district, classified employees are broken down actually into two different union groups. So we have our union group, which is the Association of Educational Support Professionals. We are the secretaries, the clerical, the paraeducators, the technology assistants. And then there's also the SEIU employee group, which is our nutritional services, bus drivers, maintenance.
So when you say support staff, they're supporting the teachers. And right now, I know the teachers and the educators are like working double time with this online stuff. So you guys are probably pretty valuable right now, aren't you?
Actually, Shannon, thank you very much for bringing that up, because we do value our work very highly. And unfortunately, our district has chosen to lay off over 350 of our members at this time.
What?
This is definitely not supporting the needs of our families and our community. We are hearing the cry, actually, of our teachers who are overworked at this time, and they do not have the additional hands that they need to be able to work online with students, which we did give support to last spring.
That's like over a third of your workforce.
Correct. We have actually 350 members who were furloughed out of 950 throughout the state. So basically, that's 4% statewide that are here, right here in Vancouver School District, that are not working with students.
4% is here in Vancouver. That seems pretty high. So is this not something that we're seeing all over the state? Explain that to me.
Actually, no. Most of the districts within the state are using their classified staff in various ways. I can talk about Spokane, Kent. They are using their support staff to do direct teaching with students. They are there helping with the Zoom conferences. They are there to make phone calls. They're following up with families. They're checking on attendance. They're doing all of the things that our district really needs, and they're not actually seeing the need for that right now. For some reason, the district seems to believe that we're not a valued unit and that we're no longer needed. So they've chosen to do this furlough for our members.
I'm confused. What you've described is pretty essential stuff. And as Shannon mentioned, the educators are working overtime to try and do all this work. What is the district's justification for furloughing these positions?
Their justification to us is the lack of funds, which we totally disagree with. Our district has $35 million in their reserve funds for a rainy day. And at this time, if COVID isn't a rainy day, I don't know what's raining. The district is basically building their rainy day fund off of this. They're claiming that they are down in attendance, and they're claiming a lot of things that really are absolutely not true. We've had our Washington Education Association analysts go out and do some real analysis on their budget and some of the resources they could have tapped into and that they could be using, and they have chosen not to do that.
You know, Barb, I think a lot of people hear about furloughs and layoffs, and the numbers start to run together after a while, especially in hard times when budgets are tight, revenue is down, but 350 people don't have a job right now, right?
Absolutely. And our members are struggling right now. They are trying to figure out how they're paying rent. They're trying to figure out now the holidays are coming, what's happening with that. We have members who have 30 plus years of seniority who have been cut and have had to try to figure out the unemployment process. They are all struggling very hard, and this is so unnecessary. It's just a disservice to our community when we should be here to help our students.
Barb, thank you so much for being here with us and talking about school employees who a lot of people depend on, but many people sometimes don't think about. Thank you, working people, for joining us on another episode of Working to Live in Southwest Washington, produced by the Southwest Washington Central Labor Council. And take Julie Olson's advice. Go out to a local restaurant. Get some takeout. Fill that growler. Let's keep our local businesses up and running through this.
And don't forget, you are supporting a local podcast that is recorded under a SAG-AFTRA collective bargaining agreement.
Local and union, you're hitting all the marks just by listening to this. Remember, working people, this is your show. We want to know what you want to hear on it. Email us at podcast@swwaclc.org or find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at SWWACLC.
Make sure you hit that subscribe button and give us a gift of you following our podcast.
And while you're at it, be sure to give us 5 stars or fill in your local bubble or whatever your podcast platform of choice gives you. Let people know about the show and let them know you like it. One last thing, folks. This is not going to be easy, and nobody likes it. But we have to stick together if we're going to get through this. I know it's going to be hard. It's especially hard during the holidays. But if we can just make it for a few months, we'll have this thing beat.
And the only way that we are going to open up our economy and put our community back to work is if we follow the protocols that will keep this virus down. So please, I know you hear it 100 times a day, but wear your mask, wash your hands, avoid crowds, and observe social distancing. Those things are not taking away your freedoms. They are assuring us that we will all make it tomorrow. So please be safe, wear your mask, and protect our community members.
Including those classified employees that we were talking about in the first part of the show. We want to get those folks back to work. But the only way we're going to do that is if we get this virus under control. So mask up, stay home, stay safe, and we'll see you soon.
Good morning. This is the Polk County Report on KMEZ Community Radio. We're broadcasting on 100.7 and 88.5 FM. You can also hear KMEZ on your phone. Just use a free app such as Simple Radio or TuneIn. Or you can hear KMEZ streaming online at onlineradiobox.com. I'm Michael Rose. My guest today is Rebecca Salinas Olivares. In the last election, Rebecca won a seat on the Monmouth City Council. What makes Rebecca's story particularly compelling is her progression from a Black Lives Matter activist to a successful city council campaign. Black Lives Matter became a controversial issue to voters in rural Polk County. What some small town residents viewed as a call for racial justice, others derided as anti-police and patriotic. Good morning, Rebecca. I think you have an interesting story to tell us.
Good morning, Michael. Thank you for having me on this morning.
Well, let's get started. Please tell us a little bit about yourself. What's your professional background? And I was wondering if you've been involved with local politics before.
Let's see. I'll start with my background coming from a migrant family. My mom brought us to Oregon from Texas at the age of 5 when I was 5 years old. We lived on a real poor ranch, and my cousins were getting addicted to drugs, and there wasn't really a lot of options for us. And so my mother had the courage to bring us here to Oregon. And I've worked in the fields probably from the age of 5 through high school. And it was really my hard labor jobs that I started thinking about going to college. I didn't even know about college. I had no idea what I was doing. I'm a first-generation student. All I knew is I didn't want to work in hard labor jobs. And so I decided I'm going to give it a go. I started at Western Oregon University as a freshman, and I learned to ask questions and build relationships, and that really helped me get through my first couple years at Western until I transferred to Oregon State University. And at Oregon State, I completed my bachelor's degree in human development, family sciences. And then I came back to Western and worked as an educational advisor for our student enrichment program. And Western was a really meaningful place for me. They helped me complete my master's degree. And that was amazing.
Why did you run for city council? Was it based in large part on your support for the local Black Lives Matter movement?
Yes, it was. I didn't plan on running for city council. This wasn't in the cards for me. But in June, it was around June 2nd, and Carol McKeel and her husband, Alan, went out after the murder of George Floyd, and they stood on the corner of 99 and Main. And they sent out an email inviting other people in the neighborhood to come and join them if they'd like. And this invitation came at such a critical time. My daughters were having such a hard time with what was happening in our country, and they were so sad and they felt so hopeless and they couldn't do anything. And how are we going to move forward from this? And so we all went out together as a family. And we stood together in protest, and when we first went out that first day, it was really emotional. And my daughters would say, wow, I feel so much hope. Look at all the different people out here. Look at all the white people who are standing with us.
Right.
I mean, we didn't know what to expect. And they're like, this is what we need. This is what it's going to take. And it was just so inspiring. And it really helped us to start the healing process. And then we thought, okay, now what? What do we do from this time on? We want to continue to educate. And so a small group of us got together and talked about how to educate our community. And so the Monmouth for Justice Facebook page was created. And really, it's an educational platform. We need to educate. There's a lot of misinformation. There's a lot of fear. Let's do what we can for our community.
Tom Henderson, a reporter at the Polk County Itemizer Observer, wrote a great story about how you went from a Black Lives Matter activist to a city council member. Tom, in his story, described a scene where you're standing on a corner with a peace sign and some people driving by gave you the finger. Do you experience that type of hostility very often? And what do you think is the source of this anger?
Yes, I deal with this. I joke around with my fellow protesters and friends out there. I feel cheated if I don't get flipped off at least once.
Okay.
And because it happens at least once every time I'm out there. And it's interesting because it's not just your casual, I'm going to flip you off. It's direct eye contact. They want me to know that they are flipping me off. And they're making eye contact as they pass. And it's interesting because you remember the truck, that same person that comes by that does this all the time. And now I'm like, wow, if I don't see that same guy in the truck who flips me off all the time, what am I going to do? When it does happen, it happens all the time. And I think part of it is flat out racism. Let's just call it what it is. But I think other parts is misinformation and not understanding why we are protesting. But I think the biggest part is fear. I think there's fear that our lives are going to change, because they are. But they're going to change for the better for everyone. And it's not about taking away liberties and freedoms or giving them to people of color. That's not what being equitable is about. And that's not what our Black Lives Movement in Monmouth is about.
My guest today was Rebecca Salinas Olivera. She's a new Monmouth City Councilor, and she had some interesting things to tell us today. Thanks for your time today, Rebecca.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael. I appreciate the opportunity.
You're listening to WLPN, 105.5 FM Chicago, and you're listening to Labor Express Radio, Chicago's only English language labor news and current affairs radio program, news for working people by working people. I'm your host, Jerry Mead Lacero, and this is the Sunday, November 29th, 2020 edition of Labor Express. No news story is dominating headlines or on people's minds more than the COVID-19 pandemic, which has now claimed over 260,000 lives and counting. More American lives have been lost to COVID than any other single event in U.S. history other than World War II and the Civil War, and it's long from over. What's receiving less attention here locally by the mainstream press, for reasons I can't fathom, is the massive cuts to our hospital network that serves working-class people of color. We reported in the past on the closing of Mercy Hospital, a private institution that nonetheless plays a central role in serving the low-income communities of color on the South Side. We've also on previous episodes reported on the proposals to make cuts to the public system itself, the primary source of medical care for tens of thousands of low-income people. That unimaginable move has happened. I have Elizabeth Lalish, a nurse at Stroger Hospital and a member of the National Nurses United, or NNU. Elizabeth works in the COVID-only section at Stroger, and she has herself contracted COVID earlier this year. I asked Elizabeth to explain what the new county budget means in regards to cuts to the hospital system.
The cuts at county entail closing the Provident emergency room and also closing two clinics on the south side of Chicago. All of this, if people know where Provident is located, is actually near Washington Park, which is heavily, if not all, African American, and it's a lower income neighborhood, poor and working class. Blacks live there, as well as people in Gage Park and other neighborhoods that serve Latino patients as well, who use Provident as their primary means of, you know, medical care. And so Provident is going to be closed. It serves 30,000 people a year, which is kind of outrageous because we're not sure what's going to happen to the 30,000 people who won't have that ER accessible to them. It creates a healthcare desert on the south side of Chicago, which, who is going to actually take care of those patients? Are they all going to come to the poorer hospitals, including mine, Stroger, which is the public health hospital? I don't know how our ER can possibly handle it. We already don't have enough staff given the COVID crisis, and we are overwhelmed. And then they're laying people off. County can justify and say, you know, we have layoffs because we're public sector and we're funded by taxpayers. Because tax income hasn't been coming in, we're strapped. But it really creates all sorts of havoc in the healthcare system that is needed the most in the city to take care of the people who are being most affected by COVID and all the patients who never came in during the spring because of COVID, who are also equally as sick and requiring care.
So you talked about the fact that, you know, shouldn't we all be in together, and this is the worst possible time for these kind of cuts to happen. We're hearing a lot about, across the country, the health system getting overwhelmed by the COVID crisis. How is it looking in Chicago from your perspective? Are you concerned now with these cuts that we're really facing a critical condition here in Chicago in terms of capacity?
The cuts, what they mean is we have fewer people. And I will be honest with you, I wouldn't be alive if it wasn't for my union. And I'm not just saying that to toot their horn, but I'm telling you, each and every one of us, at Stroger Hospital alone in the spring, over 100 of us, including myself, were COVID positive, and we got it in our workplace, right? Even though my manager asked me if maybe, because they had to ask this question, maybe you got it at the gas station, and I looked at her and I said, are you kidding me? I work in a petri dish. and you guys had no plan. You can have also all the ventilators you want and all the ICU beds. If you don't have human labor, if you don't have healthcare workers with expertise, and by this time we know what this looks like and we know what to do, but if there aren't enough of us, none of this matters. And so the crunch is that we don't have enough human labor, which is really what makes any system go under capitalism. In a different kind of society, we would be listening to people like us who are frontline healthcare workers and doctors and epidemiologists and saying, we need to actually do something about this. The experience becomes shattering after a certain point because people are so, there's so much stress, there's so much fear, and then you see too much death. I had some patients who were, they're in their early 30s. It's mind-boggling to think about that. To have cuts that cut services means you're literally sticking a knife in our backs, right? And you expect us still to handle this. And we just, I mean, we can't. And we've been fighting the hospital administration to get a plan. We had to fight them. They had no plan, nothing. And that to us is devastating. So that I think is more like the moral injury of not knowing exactly what we need and how we need to do it, but being denied that or belittled or harassed or disciplined because of it is just, that just, I think, throws people over the edge and makes them question all things about the kind of healthcare system we have in this country. So
she's also a member of National Nurses United, or NNU. In the midst of the crisis, as you heard, the nurses have started contract negotiations. This is something that has not been discussed nearly at all in the mainstream press, and it could be an interesting development in regards to the nurses ramping up their fight for better handling of the COVID crisis and in defense of patient-centered care. I asked Elizabeth about this.
Well, I mean, we started contract negotiations. Our contract expires on the 30th, and all of the unions at within the county system and at the hospital expire on November 30th. It's pretty typical we go into negotiations. We're doing that in conjunction with some of the other unions at the hospital, including Service Employees International Union Local 73, which is also looking to do some escalating actions over the next couple of weeks and months. 73 is the same local that the Chicago Teachers Union struck with and won with around this time last year, right? So there's a changing local, and we're finding that, you know, I mean, some people have asked me the question about, is this some new thing? Where's all the solidarity coming? But also there was a strike at University of Illinois Chicago at the hospital within the university system, where 73 came together with the Illinois Nurses Association, and that I think is what people should be seeing for the future, is that unions are going to come across together, which I think is incredibly promising and powerful step. And it helps us with all the distress we have because, you know, if I think of nothing better to actually do is, you know, it's very emotional, but it's good to get angry and it's good to actually do very productive solidarity work together. So that's what we're looking towards, you know, and we also realize withholding our labor is probably in varying ways, you know, escalating to that is the only thing that employers in this country are going to listen to. And essential workers have to take that, we're planning on taking that leadership role along with, there's been something like 16 different healthcare strikes over the last, or collective actions over the last year. It's going to keep going. Believe me, it'll keep going. So,
well, that's all for tonight's program, but you can always find out more by visiting our Facebook page again at laborexpress.org, laborexpress.org.
This is John Andercheck, recording for the podcast Labor Lines. With me
via cell phone from New York City. Our three organizers, comrades with Restaurant Workers Council. I've interviewed them once before. It's a great organization. They're really doing the work necessary, the long haul work of organizing a democratic and independent workers organization for restaurant workers. I have with me Diego and Jesus returning, and a new member or new comrade, new representative, Jason. So I'm just going to leave it up to you folks. You could, to what extent, like to introduce yourselves, and we'll start talking about your group and what it's been doing.
Sure. Thanks, John, for having us on. I've been in the restaurant industry my entire life. It's something of a family tradition. My great-grandparents were in restaurants, and my grandparents and my parents. And, you know, what's really been unique about this time is just seeing the problems that have existed on individual level kind of come forward for everyone all at once. With the coronavirus meeting the economic crisis right now, I think we have highlighted for the first time for everyone just how important it is for unity to be brought to this industry, for the workers of this industry. So I'm really happy to be a part of this project right now. Again, just thanks for having us on.
Right. So I'm Diego. I'm also one of the organizers for the RWC, CDR, as we say. I've been working in restaurants for nearly a decade, like actually before my adult life. Been living in the city, working in restaurants since then for quite some time now. And like Jason, many of us in our sector, it became clear at this time that all the problems that we had seen individually, all of them that bothered us in numerous ways and shaped our lives in a more piece by piece way, affected us all in a very new way all at once. The lack of job security for wages, lack of protections for our immigrant worker comrades, all of that very much came to the fore. The initiators of the project actually made several years ago, restaurant workers, cafeteria workers struggled at the new school years ago, which left a very strong impression on us.
Para los trabajadores, que es la parte que a nosotros nos conviene, por la que nosotros estamos en este proyecto, por los trabajadores.
Mm-hmm. This was saying, he says Jesus, he's from Honduras. He's a restaurant worker, immigrant, Latino. He says he's very proud to be a part of this project. Thanks to John for having us on again. It's very important for him and for all of us to be able to bring something for all the workers in the sector, particularly those that are immigrants that might not be documented, that might not speak English, and for those reasons might not have an opportunity to really change their circumstances. And that's why we want to be part of this project and why we work for the future in this way. He says he believes that with the unity that we have in the group and the program and all of that, that we really have a chance of changing the sector very dramatically, that we understand that the path will be long and difficult, but that we can really concretely do something to change our circumstances.
Go right ahead and talk more about the Restaurant Workers Council. Thank you.
Many of us are restaurant workers for many years as well. And when March 15th came around with a stroke of a pen, almost every single restaurant worker in New York City, which I believe amount to hundreds of thousands, were immediately out of work. We saw an opportunity and also a need to take action. So we put out an initial call, built an organizing committee and a wide group of loose contacts. And we've spent a lot of time learning about the sector, learning about the history of organizing in our sector, which is very interesting. It's not something that's commonly known. People's general ignorance about the labor movement is one thing, but about the ignorance of the labor movement in the restaurant industry, there's almost nobody is familiar with it. So that was very interesting, kind of clarifying the path towards a unionization, the need for a democratic and independent union that organizes all workers together. Our position is that a union would do away with the hierarchy of wages and would negotiate a uniform, high hourly wage with benefits for every single worker in the restaurant, that these things would be obsolete if workers were powerful enough to dictate the terms of their employment.
That's excellent. Yeah, I've worked at places where you did that tip sharing and all. And again, it's another tool for dividing the workforce, in my opinion. Coming up to the half hour here, as I just said a moment ago, this is John Andertrek. I'm recording this for both the radio show Labor Lines on KRFP and my podcast Labor Lines.
All right, bud, the red light is on. So welcome to the show. Today I have Richard Roth with me, business agent Richard Roth. And the reason for today's podcast episode is we've got a new to us anyway effort that was born of the eBoard just recently. And I just wanted to talk about the idea that they presented and what we're doing moving forward, and just try to promote it a little bit so people have all the information. The eBoard wanted to do something for the holidays, regardless of our situations throughout the year. Like, sometimes people just find themselves in a hard place, and the worst time to find yourself in a hard place is this time of year with the holidays, surrounded by holidays. We have, you know, back-to-back months. You have Thanksgiving, and then you have Christmas and New Year's, and it's like rapid fire, big holidays. And it's a real bad time to find yourself in bad times. And our guys on our eBoard were talking about it and just felt a call to make sure we had something available for our members. It finally got to a point where one of our members, Justin Blue, said, he was like, man, like, we're talking about working within the constraints of union business. Is there a way we can do this where we just do it on our own? Like, we just donate our own time and our own money, and which, that's a whole new ballgame.
Yeah.
And so we came up with this idea of, I put a graphic together. I put brothers and sisters helping brothers and sisters, because that's really what it is. So the game plan is, any members that know of any members that may be on some hard times, or maybe you yourself are a member that's just had a bit of bad luck heading into the holidays, and you could use a little bit of help, reach out to us. Reach out to, you can contact the hall, you can contact the business manager, the agents, me, anyone on the eBoard. Hit one of us up and give us some names. I understand that we're a humble group. We don't like, man, I try to get some of the guys to come on to do this podcast, and I didn't have any takers, because we, like, our guys just don't like, they're not doing any of this for credit. They're doing this because they want to do this for people. Yeah. But the point is,
don't be ashamed of it.
If it's there and you need it, to just come. This is as discreet. We'll make this as discreet as can be. We don't need to broadcast names of people that we're helping or anything like that. Just shoot a text message, call anonymously, and give us a name of somebody that is falling on some hard times, maybe, or could just use a little bit of some good fortune or a helping hand. And
if you're one of the people that are in excellent shape or good shape, we're accepting all donations to try to put together baskets and deliver. And yeah, we're going to do this on our own, but we want as much help as possible from the membership. To donate. And if you've got something you want to donate, perishable, non-perishable items, canned goods or something like that, and you can drop them off at the hall, or you can text me or anyone else. And
Same applies to anyone that wants to help. Yeah. Contact the same people. Yeah.
We can come get it. We can be contactless. You can leave it outside in the porch on a bag. You can drop it off at the union hall. As of right now, the hall's pretty much on lockdown. It's the other people, tenants in that building that don't want anybody else in there. If you bring something, you knock on a door and just leave it in a chair out there, or leave it on the picnic tables, and we'll get it. And what we're going to do with it is we're going to divvy it up amongst the people that needs it. And like Jeremy said, I've gotten a few names so far, and I'm really hoping it's a catch 22. I'm hoping we get names. But I also like it that no one needs help. But I know people out there need help.
Yeah.
I just hope they don't have enough pride, so much pride that they won't ask us for help. Because it's anonymous. We're not going to put anybody's names out there. Hey, Richard Roth really needed help, and we had to give him a turkey and a ham and sweet potatoes. Nothing like that. Nope. We're doing this to help our members out. And and it's anonymous.
Yeah.
The only ones that knows who's going to get it is basically the hall, because we'll be, or whoever you reach out to and to say, hey, Richard Roth, I'm just using myself, so I don't mention anybody else's name. Hey, Richard Roth needed help. Can we get him together something for Christmas? Yeah. And then because of our position, we can get a basket together and we can take it out there, knock on their door, leave it on their porch, and do stuff like that for the membership.
Yep.
Absolutely. And no one wants to take credit for it. This came from the e-board. Like I said, Justin Blue brought it up and everybody started think tanking on it, and it just really went off really well.
Yes.
And we'd love to have had some e-board members that would have reached out and said, hey, I want to be part of this. And they would be on this podcast with Jeremy. But no one really likes to put themselves out and to think that they're doing something for kudos. And right. Jeremy and I is not doing that either. We just happen to we want to get the message out.
And we're a couple of talkers. So that,
So that's
the big thing. Yeah.
All right. Yep. So I'm going to blast again on Facebook. I'm sure you will also. And I hope we get as much participation in this as we can get.
Yes, sir. All right, man. Hey, thanks for doing this with me, Richard, so I didn't have to sit here talk to a wall.
And always glad to be part of it, Jeremy. Always glad to be part.
Right on, man. So as always, everybody, take care. Watch out for one another. And don't be lending out your snips. Hang on to those things. Maybe you can pass them down to the next generation.
Amen.
See you, brother.
All right, buddy. Talk to you later.
To Dissent Magazine's Belabored podcast, hosted by Sarah Jaffe and Michelle Chen.
Hey, Sarah.
Hi, Michelle.
And welcome to Belabored episode 211. In this episode, we're talking about how unions can adapt to 21st century capitalism with Alice Martin and Annie Quick, authors of Unions Renewed, Building Power in an Age of Finance.
Now that the election is over, we can think about the future. One of the biggest challenges, or rather quite a few of the biggest challenges for organized labor on both sides of the Atlantic, has been the question of how to adapt to a financialized economy, a fissured workplace, and a capitalism that would like to get along with as few workers as possible. Alice Martin and Annie Quick are the co-authors of a new book, Unions Renewed, Building Power in an Age of Finance, that takes up that very question in depth from the position not just of thinkers and finance analysts, but of organizers. We sat down for a conversation recently to talk about their book and their ideas for a future for the labor movement.
Hi, I'm Alice Martin, and I work advising shareholders on labor rights and labor risks issues, and I'm a co-author of Unions Renewed, which I think we're going to be discussing today.
Hello, I am Annie Quick, and I'm a trade union organiser working for the IWGB, which is one of the smaller trade unions here in the UK, working in the area of care.
Excellent. So you have written this book that is about how unions can renew themselves in a financialized capitalist economy. And so I wanted to start because there's a story that you tell right at the beginning of the book that I didn't know, and I thought I knew all of the horrifying things that specifically Walmart had done to its workers. But it's a story about Walmart taking out life insurance policies on its employees and how this helps avoid taxes. And while this is not a process that is ongoing, I feel like I need to ask you to talk about this a little bit because it's horrifying and it, I think, sets up your book really well.
Yeah, horrifying is exactly the right word. This is the kind of really grim side of all of this stuff. So it's a practice called dead peasants in insurance. And I think the name gives away how grim it is. And it was particularly prominent in the 1990s. And it basically involves employers taking out life insurance on workers, normally without their knowledge. And what that means is that effectively, if a worker passes away, then their relatives find out that their employer is suddenly cashing in to tens of thousands of dollars, often on literally on the death of their loved one, whereas they probably don't get a penny unless they have life insurance themselves. And companies like Walmart, together, they spent over $8 billion on these kinds of schemes. And it's the reason that we open with it is that it really illustrates the way in which finance capital is finding more and more creative ways to make money off us as workers. So in this situation, with Walmart isn't just making money off the work that workers do and the productive capacity that involves, they're actually using workers as assets to speculate on.
I want to ask you, a lot of our listeners are probably familiar with some of this history, but just to give us a brief history of the deregulation that led to the financialized economy that we have now. Like, this could be like very brief history.
Sure. So if we think, first of all, if we think of financialization and sort of finance capitalism as a sort of trend towards the increased size and influence of finance sector. And by that, we mean not just things like currency trading and stock market trading, the kind of things that you, the images you might get when you say finance, but also a whole load of other parts of our economy. So banking, insurance, and real estate. So those things have existed for hundreds of years, right? And particularly in the UK, finance is a very dominant part of our economy and has always been quite dominant because, in particular, because of our history of colonialism and imperialism and the way that sort of finance came out of a lot of that. But it's really grown to prominence, particularly in the 1980s, as you say, particularly as part of a deregulation agenda. So it was part of a sort of neoliberal shift towards deregulating the finance industry. And there was various different sort of deregulations to mean that banks and finance capital had more freedom about what they were able to do. And as a result, the influence and the size of that part of the economy has grown and grown since the 1980s, which is why economists have come up with this term called financialization. But as I say, I think it's really important not to think of this as a sector of the economy, which is over there. Financialization is about the influence of finance in so many areas of our everyday economic lives. So the financialization of the housing market is the reason that so many people are struggling to get onto the housing ladder and that our rents are so high. The role of debt and sort of the predatory loan system mean that many of us are ending up living off payday loans more than we are able to live off our wages. There's all sorts of ways in which finance is affecting every part of the economy.
Yeah, and I think we're really keen to push the fact that we don't think these are separate worlds, as Annie says. So it's not the case of this good old world of, you know, graft and manufacturing where we all made things and sold them and we were all really happy versus this new bad world of kind of financial trading. But in fact, the two are embroiled and historically have been embroiled. But the case now is that the process of making money from different types of financial engineering happens in more areas of our lives and also in the industries in our economy as well. So something we talk about in the book is, maybe we'll talk about some of the financialized sectors a bit later on. So care is one of the examples that we cover, but also how the finance sector kind of profits from an erosion of workers' rights. And Uber and the kind of Uber models is quite a good example of this. You know, where we have a situation where workers' rights are eroded, whether because of endemic low wages or a lack of holiday or sick pay, then there's a kind of space opened up for financialization to happen. So in the case of Uber, we've got workers taking out loans to buy their cars. So their kind of means of production, their means of working, their cars, they take out loans. They then begin their work in debt. So they're having to earn wages to pay off that debt and to pay interest on that debt, which then goes to the bank. They also then have to pay a form of rent just to use the Uber app. So a form of rent to the company, so that the company is in a way sort of rent seeking from them as well as treating them like workers. And then the fact that they don't have holiday and sick pay means they have to rely on financial products really to cover their income if they get ill. So that might be loans, payday loans, insurance products, and companies themselves are profiting off that negligence that they've taken, that position of negligence. So in the case of Uber, they've actually designed their own insurance products and sold them back to Uber drivers to cover their backs when they need to take time off. So that we cover some examples in the book like this to try and show that financialization is not this kind of lofty concept up there, but actually we're all living through it. We're embroiled in it in our daily lives and in our work.
You've been listening to Dissent Magazine's Belabored podcast. For the entire archive of past episodes, visit dissentmagazine.org. Join us online using hashtag Belabored.
Welcome to the first edition of How Does That Work? A special series within the Grit Northwest podcast built to help listeners from the Northwest Carpenters Union better understand the numerous services, benefits, and advantages available to them as members. In today's episode, we will meet the president of the Northwest Carpenters Union and Grit Northwest writer, producer, and host, Joe Cadwell. We'll begin our conversation by discussing what Grit Northwest, a carpenter's podcast, is and what it hopes to achieve. We'll then delve into the often referenced show notes and why he feels they are so important to check out. Next, we'll discuss the benefits of joining Grit Nation and why it's more than just a chance at winning a free t-shirt. And we'll wrap up our conversation with a call to action, where Joe will ask you to subscribe to his podcast. And now, on to the show. Joe Cadwell, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks for having me on the show.
So, Joe, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Well, Joe, I'm a member of the Local 196, an instructor slash coordinator at PNCI, and the president of the Northwest Carpenters Union. I worked as a commercial diver for approximately...
Yeah, that's great to hear. So what's the deal with your podcast? Where did the concept for Grit Northwest, a Carpenters Union podcast, come from?
Great question, Joe. So the idea for Grit Northwest came to me in late August, right after the regional council elections, where I was reelected to the role of regional council president. I knew I wanted to expand the role of president in order to help our members better understand their union and the many benefits that they have over their non-union counterparts. And with COVID-19 weighing heavy on everyone's ability to travel, I figured a podcast would be a great platform to do that.
So as the host of a moderately successful podcast with limited variety and content, what's your experience been like so far?
Well, thanks for that, I think. Initially, it was a pretty steep learning curve, as you can imagine. But I'm happy to say that things are now finally starting to click and even out. As you know, the show is interview-based, so I really try to find guests who can add value to my listeners' lives. The guests provide the content, and I facilitate the conversation.
And within your show, I've noticed that you have a number of different themes. There's the check-in, the spotlight, fight club, and get to know a local better. In regard to your creative process, I understand whiskey sometimes plays a key role. Is there any truth to that?
Well, not always, but I'll admit a few drams of open scotch definitely had a hand in this one.
So moving on, I've noticed that you keep directing the listeners of your podcast to something called the show notes after every episode. What are these show notes and why the big push?
Great question, Joe. The podcast show notes are an in-depth written account of what happened during the episode and contain resources, usually in the form of hyperlinks, that take the content one step further. Those hyperlinks might include links to articles mentioned in the show, guest bios, videos, and relevant calls to actions. You can find these as well as a written transcript to some of the longer interviews on the website. They're also just below the episode on whatever podcast player you're using, such as Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher.
Wow, great answer. Sounds like you were ready for that one. Let's try another one. Grit Nation, what is it, and why ask your listeners to join it?
Thanks again for another great question, Joe. It's almost like you're reading my mind. Kind of creepy. So Grit Northwest is where fans of the show and those members that want to take their union involvement to the next level can experience perks that the casual listeners don't have access to. It's still a work in progress, I'll admit, but aside from the ability to win an official I've Got Grit t-shirt, members get advanced previews of upcoming episodes, access to insider content, and can even help steer the show's direction and focus through member surveys. As the show continues to grow, the Grit Nation benefits will follow.
Well, Joe, this has been a great conversation. Where can listeners go to find out more about Grit Northwest and Grit Nation?
How about the show notes I mentioned earlier? And if you haven't already done so, please subscribe to Grit Northwest by clicking on the subscribe button. Episodes will be automatically downloaded to your phone when you do.
Joe Cadwell, thanks again for taking your time to be on the show.
Thank you, Joe. It's been a pleasure.
Our guest today has been Joe Cadwell, host of a moderately successful podcast. If you'd like today's episode, please be sure to share it with a friend, family member, or coworker. And if you haven't already done so, please take a minute to write a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll help others find the show. Till next time, this is Joe Cadwell reminding you to work safe, work smart, and stay union strong.
Christmas tree, you stand serene, in winter shroud your evergreen. The worker's flag, though his deepest red, it shrouded oft our martyred dead. So raise the scarlet standard high, beneath its folds we'll live and With unity, our path is clear. We'll keep the red flag flying here.
That's the Tony Award-winning San Francisco Mime Troupe, their production of A Red Carol, a working-class take on the Dickens holiday classic, begins streaming on December 11th. For more information, visit sfmt.org. That'll about do it for this edition of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, our roundup of highlights from nearly 80 labor radio shows and podcasts. The Labor Radio Podcast Network shows focus on working people's issues and concerns. We've got links to all the network shows at laborradionetwork.org. And you can also find them by using the hashtag LaborRadioPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Labor Radio Podcast Weekly was edited by Evan Papp and Patrick Dixon, produced by me, and our social media guru is Harold Phillips. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at LaborRadioNet. Find out more on our website, laborradionetwork.org. Also, check out our new weekly live stream show available at Labor Radio Net on Facebook and Labor Radio Podcast Network on YouTube, where you'll also find profiles of members of the network. For Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, this is Chris Garlock urging you to stay active and, of course, stay tuned to your local Labor Radio podcast show. See you next week.